You could have had money for the wall, but the wall is not the issue. And the border, this very real stretch of land with people and families and businesses and churches on both sides of the line, is not the issue. The issue is what this country as a whole looks like and who gets to call it theirs, which is why the wall will never be built and always be needed, why the border will never actually be secure but always need to be secured. It's because America cannot be and will not be, one hopes, the kind of nation that those folks want, the president, his advisors, one bound fundamentally by ethnic and racial affiliation rather than a collective vision of a free society.
It is Friday, February 15th, 2019, one day after Valentine's Day. My heart is like a red, red flag. And now officially, National Emergency Day. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week I talk to our Capitol muckraker in chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. This week's show, yes indeed, as we started to record today, Trump says he will declare that national emergency we keep hearing about to get border wall funding.
Everybody does it. Lots of people have done it before. It's really not that big of a deal. So I need my wall.
Despite earlier warnings against declaring a national emergency, Mitch McConnell is all on board with Trump now. And now he supports declaring a national emergency, perfectly fine with ceding over the Congress's constitutional control over the nation's purses, handed it over to the dictator. There you go. And meanwhile, McConnell, thinking that he's being politically smart, is going to force a vote on Green New Deal resolution introduced by AOC and Senator Markey. I think that one's going to blow up in his face, actually. Beto O'Rourke met with Schumer, met with Chucky, to discuss a 2020 Senate run. So we might be hearing from Beto pretty quickly. Does this mean that Beto is not going to be running for president? I think actually the Senate run is actually a smarter run, but Denver teachers went on strike, first time in over several decades. After 3 days, they come away with a win. As Sean always says, direct action gets the goods. Amazon got its foo-foos hurt by community protest and kills its H2Q plans for New York City. New York City collectively cheers and jumps and has a 3-day rave in celebration. Not really, but it's kind of. So guess what, Governor Wolf, you get your second chance. Bring it on Amazon. That'll help. New GOP. What's that?
So thankfully not.
Yeah. The new GOP proposal calls for employers to take student loan payments directly out of employees' paychecks. Let that sink in there for a second. Debtor nation. And the atmospheric river dumps record rain on California. It's like the equivalent of something like 35 Mississippi rivers hanging up in the sky. And there's really serious concerns about mudslides, especially after the summer of fire. Today's a little closer to home PA focus. Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman's marijuana legalization tour, get the train going, starts rolling through central Pennsylvania. Hundreds of supporters show up at the Dauphin and Cumberland County stops. Who would have thought? Well, Fetterman knew. House Democratic Labor and Industry Chair Pat Harkins is back on board with Governor Wolf's minimum wage plan after he was taken out in the shed for a little bit. Post-Gazette editor John Block went on an epically drunken rant in the Gazette News on Saturday. Caught on film. Thank you, cell phones. Block had his young daughter with him, and he demanded to get a photo in front of a poster that read, "Shame on the Blocks." PASSY Chancellor Daniel Greenstein testifies at PA budget hearings. He seemed to give a shot across the bow to the faculty union, saying that unless the relationship changes, becomes more collaborative, read, does what I want, saving PASSY is a fool's errand. And in that same vein, tomorrow, I'm heading out to Kutztown to join some of my brothers and sisters from Kutztown and a couple other Kashi universities to go through some labor notes training. That's what gets the goods, right, Sean? And today's last call, Free Will's got a double can release. Sean can't shake the sinus blues. Star Trek Discovery update. And then Sean can tell us a little bit about, he's been watching Oliver Stone's Untold Histories. And those histories, there's something. I'll tell you. Especially right now, after all the kind of little dust up around Abrams' nomination to be ambassador to Venezuela, bringing back the Central American Death Squad memories. And Raging Chicken Studios gets a little remodel. I feel like I can stretch out now. And do we have some new writers on the horizon? We'll give you a little insider's look about some things that we're thinking about moving towards here in the future. I want to remind everybody, tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org. You can also tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. Make sure you download the daily Rick Smith Show podcast on iTunes, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcast. And if we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. You can help support Hold No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Not only can you tell your friends all about what's going on, not only can you share this podcast, not only can you kind of like tell everybody, did you hear what they were talking about? Did you read what she wrote? Right? Nope. You can actually become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. If you're not ready to become a member, no problem. Just go to ragingchickenpress.org and click the big blue donate button in the sidebar. Best way to invest in keeping the media in the movement in the media, is to become a member. $5 a month, patreon.com/rcpress. Do it today, folks. Step up. So, Sean, man, happy Friday. Day after Valentine's Day, National Emergency Day now.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says. So you're still not feeling so good, huh?
No, not too great. It's been a slow week.
It's been a slow week.
Yeah. No, it's been a slow week. I woke up with a sinus cold yesterday, and I think I still have it a little bit. My nose is stuffy. And yeah, enjoying all that good stuff.
Enjoying all that good stuff, yes. Well, you know, the weather has not exactly been helping you out, going from, like, you know, negative 10 to 60 degrees in over a two-day period.
Then back down into the 20s, and then
yep.
It's up in the 50s again, yeah. It's just so nice where I think, like, I want to declare a national emergency and force through the Green New Deal.
There you go. I'm all for
Medicare
it.
For all around it.
It's like, set some precedent here, right? Like, agenda yeah. Item number one for 2020 after a Democratic Party sweep of all three branches of government.
We just need, like, someone to declare a national emergency. So, like, we get a new president, and we declare a national emergency on all the billionaires out there, and we round them up into a gulag, and we never hear from them again. We seize their wealth and redistribute to everyone. And we now live in an egalitarian society from here on out.
There you go. Well, okay, and podcast.
Yeah.
That's all we need.
I think it's a great platform to like, run on. But first, we stack the courts.
Yeah, you stack the courts. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what some of the Republicans are like, deathly afraid of, right? That's what they're trying. Some of them tried to, like, wave Trump off of this because of the precedent that it could set for, you know, future presidents. Like, it has nothing to do with, like, you know, the building this wall, right, and the racist rhetoric and all that. No, no, no. It's simply a political the reasons are simply political because they're worried that what a Democratic president in the future could go, especially if it's a progressive one. So that's all they really care about is the press.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, of course. I don't see Roberts supporting this in front of the Supreme Court. Like, I don't see them. I mean, like, because of the undue precedent it can get. But, I mean, like, for all we know, last year's election could have been the last national election we ever had. So it's like.
Right. Well, you know, national emergency does bring about some extraordinary power. So
Yeah.
So, but here's the thing. I mean, like, look, I mean, this is going to play itself out and it's going to be all over the media for days. I'm like, I actually, you know, it's hard for me not to, I've actually got the live stream on my phone. I'm looking down at it and Trump is still going on right now. He's taking questions from people about this. I can't hear the questions right now and stuff, but I mean, this is going to be, you know, dominate the news cycle now for several days. And maybe longer, but there is a real, you know, the real concern here, right? The real concern is there's actually been he's actually going to declare a national emergency for something that is not objectively a national emergency, and that sets a weird precedent.
Yeah, we're in that like weird stage of empire.
Yep. Like, and you know, like last night, Rachel Maddow last night had this segment on the show about his medical report, which was just released. Right? Did you see all this?
Yeah, apparently he weighs 234 pounds.
And he's 6'3".
And he's lighter than me.
Right. Well, you know, there's some suggestion that they had to kind of like bump up his height to make sure that his body mass didn't kind of qualify him as obese. Right. So that was one of the reasons why they're showing them high. I don't know. I have no idea if that's what it is. But what Maddow showed, right, is like a whole series of these pictures of him standing next to people who are actually like 6'2". Right. And he's shorter than them. Right. And her point with this, and then like, you know, this picture of him like pointing out like this, and then having the original photo and seeing when the White House released and it found out that they lengthened his finger.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like stuff like this. And like her point of it was like, who
this
cares?
Is not how normal people act.
But yeah, but exactly. But like, this is not even like, who cares if he's 6'3" versus 6'6". Right. But why your national like medical report. Right, the U.S. government is lying to you about the president's weight and height, and for what reason? It's so freaking bonkers.
It's vanity. It's like, I mean,
well, exactly.
It is like it's a sociopathic.
Exactly.
You have a sociopathic authoritarian in the White House.
Right.
I mean, we've seen this before. I mean, with Hitler, Stalin, like others, like, and how vain these people are, and narcissistic, like. Yeah, is this like a surprise that they faked his medical report?
No, and it's like, and I think her report or her point in that too was that it's not a surprise at this point.
This guy is not fit to be holding office,
right? And it's also a bit. It has an effect, right, on all like the rest of the country and all of us that this is just like part of the routine. Yep, there's lying again. Right. And they're just saying this kind of stuff and everything's kind of made up. And you just wonder, like, at what point if something happens, right, who the hell knows what that could be? Does this shift from being kind of like this, you know, sociopathic, kind of narcissistic, like vanity ridden, ridiculous human being to something that becomes much darker? And that's always been that kind of concern is that, you know, I think that I have a new appreciation, I think, of the like being in a culture at a point where there's a rise of authoritarian rule, because I that kind of bewilderment, I think, has got to be part of the process where you're looking around. And I think objectively, if you pull yourself back and you look at what's been happening for the past few years, it is objectively really disturbing and should be throwing off kind of alarm bells. But
this is like, this has been their end game for like 30, 40 years now.
Well, that's absolutely true. Right. That's
like,
absolutely
Trump
true.
Just had to be the person that came along at that point in time.
Right. Well, I think the big difference, I think, is that the goal up until now has been, kind of, you know, kind of oligarchic rule, right? It's been plutocracy. And the plutocracy with the veneer of kind of a republic, so that you basically are going to keep the mass of people kind of arm's length away from where the actual power lies. Right? So I think that's been the game especially for the past 30, 40 years. I mean, it's been much longer, but I think, you know, as in terms of a conscious, programmatic, strategic kind of move, that's been where, say, the Republican Party and, you know, Koch brother folks and all that, that's where they've been coming from. And now the difference is right now is that, you know, you've basically put the mobster in the White House, right, where, you know, it seamlessly blends kind of corruption, like lying and all that. Because, like, you know, if you think, for example, if you think that if you don't think that lying is bad, right? If you think lying is part of what you do in order to maintain particular power, right? Then a whole bunch of other things follow from that, right? If I don't care, if I put my hand on the Bible and I swear to tell the whole truth, so, and I just kind of, like, I'll tell you whatever I want to think, that's going to think to be my advantage, and it has no effect whatsoever, right? And it's a different kind of world.
And there's also, if you look at it, I mean, he's putting the architects of this world in back into these powerful positions. You know, Elliot Abrams, William Barr, like, I mean, people look at, like, George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan as these great statesmen. I mean, they had some of the biggest pieces of shit working for them.
Yep.
Like, genocidal maniacs working for them at the time. Like, I mean, and, you know, and look who's coming back again in the fray. These people who were involved with, like, the genocides in Latin America and the covering up of Ronald Reagan's crimes with the Contras. And look who's... Look, they're gaining power again in this administration 30 years later.
Yep.
These are the people who will never go away.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So, I mean, so that's kind of where we're at. And, you know, so we'll see how how it all plays out. I'm trying to actually hold two things, like, in my head at the same time here. That is, on the one hand, about the actual seriousness of, like, kind of, like, what they're doing, and the pure political theater part of this, which is really what's at stake in this whole thing. That's why you heard in the intro today, that was Chris Hayes from his show last night. He was doing a show from the border. And I think he's got the, you know, hit the nail on the head with exactly this, is that the wall is the symbol of, you know, he didn't use these words, but I will, but of white nationalism, right? Of kind of, make America white again. And it will always be the symbol that will always need defending, because it's not really about the wall. It's not really about kind of security. It's about preserving white nationalist identity of America for a few people. And I think that's what we're kind of, up against. So here we go. So happy National Emergency Day, everybody. So the one thing I've been dying to ask you about is, like, so you got McConnell. McConnell was first, like, I'll say, warning Trump. It was all in the news. McConnell says, you know, that you should not do a national emergency, will not be good. And you start here reporting that it was off the table. And now McConnell has, as expected, right? You know, I think we would expect now he's just kind of, flip the switch. Oh, yeah, sure. I'm all behind it now. And he's going to let this go. So that's what's going on, the national emergency thing. But meanwhile, right, this has been all the headlines for past couple of days, is that McConnell is now saying that he's going to go ahead and he's going to force a vote in the Senate on the Green New Deal resolution introduced by AOC and Senator Markey. So I'm just kind of curious your take on all this.
I think it's a cynical effort, cynical ploy to get senators who think they might be vulnerable in 2020 to come out and vote against AOC's Green New Deal.
So,
and I think it's going to backfire.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the thing, right? So,
it's a cynical ploy that's been used over and over again in politics, just right. So you can get people on the record without, like, having any substance of debate with it whatsoever.
Right. So he's going to force.
I mean, I don't.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I don't care if people vote. I don't know. Like, they shouldn't vote no on it. But I mean, if people vote no on it, you have to realize this was going to go nowhere. And people who voted no are like, no, we're not taking part in your childish games.
Right. But, like, it's like if they vote in favor of the resolution, right? Right. Well, if you vote against the resolution, right, now you're on the record of being against the Green New Deal. Right. It seems to me that
also the Republicans. I mean, so the Republicans, Pennsylvania did this back with Wolf. They ran, like, Wolf severance tax, mm-hmm, in the House with no strings attached to it outside of when it was supposed to be part of the budget deal. Mm-hmm. And every Democrat voted against it. And so, like, they use that as, like, language saying, you know, like, not even the Democrats support your own plan. Like, this is just the same thing. We're like, they're not even debating on the merits of anything. I don't know. It's just disingenuous non-debate. And I could see if people, like, vote against it for, like, saying, I'm not participating in this bullshit.
But like, why would? But okay. But so, But it seems to me, right? So if, but my understanding, right, is they're voting on the resolution.
Yeah.
Right? So they're going to force a vote on the actual resolution itself. Now, from the get-go, right, both Senator Markey and AOC have been clear about this, that they understand this is not the bill, right? This is not a bill. This is a resolution to set the terms of the debate, right, to build support. So from the get-go, and she talked about it. We talked about this on the podcast last week, right? She was explicit about this is a organizing tool. Right. This is about organizing towards something. Right. You know, we've talked about this on this program for how long, about saying you have to actually set the horizon right in a public way and go after that. And what I do agree that what McConnell is trying to do, I read that as he's trying to kind of discipline members of his own caucus. And he wants to get Democrats to get on board of that because he thinks campaigning against them on that is actually going to be a winner. I think it's going to be exactly the opposite. And AOC has said as much. She comes out and she's like, great, this is awesome. Have them vote on it. And let's get everybody on the record to do this. Because AOC's thing is like, yeah, let's get them on the record. And we're either going to primary the freaking Democrats who vote against it, right? And then we're going to go directly after the Republicans as one people who are standing in the way of addressing climate change. I mean, that seems to me to be like a really interesting political dynamic.
Yeah, but you're not going to primary the Democrats who aren't going to vote for it, like over this issue.
You're not? Are you sure?
I think it would be stupid, yeah.
Why would it be stupid?
I don't know. I mean... Why would you waste time and effort into primary Democrat in this year? Like, I
because
went primary...
we got 12 years to address climate change.
Well, I know that, but I don't think this is a primaryable. Like, I see a bunch of Democrats just voting no for the sake of we're not going to participate in this nonsense. And I like my expectations are going to be set low to where you're not going to get every Democrat to vote yes on this.
I think it would be stupid for a Democrat to vote against it.
I think it would be too, but I don't see like
what is there's no stakes, right? What's the stakes for the Democrats on this one?
Because they don't want to have to be a campaign issue running against in next year in 2020.
And why wouldn't they want to? Because it's a losing issue.
Because they're afraid the Republicans are going to use it as a mallet,
right? Yes. And so you primary
they're afraid
the
Republicans are going to use it as a mallet, and therefore they're not going to vote for it. And they're just
I just look. I like the move. If your Democrats are going to vote against it because they think it's a cynical ploy,
like if Bob Casey votes against it, like
I think it's to their
would
own.
Would you be surprised if like Casey votes against it? I mean,
The stakes of it. If it was the bill, the full funding of the bill, or something like this, right?
Where they're primary of offense.
This is a resolution. You're telling me that you would prefer to be afraid of Republicans as opposed to kind of like bolstering up the power of your caucus? That's a problem.
But that's how they operate.
That's a problem.
That's why all these Democrats in Pennsylvania vote for pro-choice, pro-life legislation.
Exactly.
Because they're afraid of Republicans using it back home against them, even though they're in 65-35 districts.
Exact. But how many times have you talked about, out of your mouth, too, as well, saying they've got to freaking stand up, right, and campaign for something and stop being afraid?
Yeah.
Right? That these issues are winning issues. And I think that's AOC's point, right? AOC's point is, like, this is not something to run from.
But also you saw what, did you see Mark Kelly's, Gabby Gifford's husband's campaign announcement video this week?
I did not.
So he announced...
He's running for president?
No, he's running for Senate of Arizona against McSally. So he's like the first big-time Democrat to come out. He raised like $600,000 in a day.
Holy crap. That could potentially mean that the state goes all blue in terms of the Senate?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, so he specifically said like corporate money, like basically said like the things he's against is corporate money. He named gerrymandering as a big issue. And he also named climate change like as an issue that like is causing droughts in Arizona and stuff that we have to start like addressing.
Please tell me that Major Tom is going to be his theme song. How do you know about climate change? I've seen it from the freaking space station.
But no, I mean, like, it's a tearjerker of a video.
Oh, man, I got to watch it. I totally missed it.
I mean, like, Gabby Giffords is in it. So it's like she's speaking. It was a good video. And I think, like, he's probably gonna be like a hands down Democratic pick, and which I don't mind if something like that, like Dems just say, okay, you're gonna be our candidate here in Arizona to get run against McSally. But yeah, you could have two Democrats from Arizona within the next couple of years. That, and he's already put in his first campaign video, he addressed gerrymandering and climate change and corporate campaign money.
That's pretty significant.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I think that because of, you know, Gabby Gifford getting shot and the work that they've done on the, you know, on the gun issue, I think that underscores, again, why they see that money in politics is so much of a problem.
Yeah.
Right, exactly that. So it's kind of like firsthand experience, which is pretty cool. And, yeah, he's going to be moderate on a bunch of issues. But hey, you know, I'm all favor of another astronaut in the Senate. So, you know, I was really upset when John Glenn eventually stepped down because then it's like, you know. But seriously, even talking about climate change, right? You talk about climate change from your experience with kind of being involved with NASA, right? I mean, we need NASA, right, for exactly these reasons. But
and Star Force. Space Force.
Well, you got to have the Space Force. That's the Air Force now, though. That's a solved problem, right? So, so crazy. But speaking of turning Senate blue, Beto O'Rourke met with Schumer this week to discuss
another losing campaign.
I don't know about that. I don't know. I don't know if you think. Do you think he would lose that?
He's not running against Ted Cruz.
Right. But that's my point.
But it's also the type of thing like, hey, they get Beto to run specifically for down ballot races a second time around too.
Well, look, Beto O'Rourke had an incredible turnout, right? And I don't know.
We'll see. Like once Texas goes blue, that's it. Like it's going to stay blue, I think, years to come.
But that's exactly my point here, though. I think this is part of that process. I think they need to keep on testing this.
Yeah,
I think him running in 2020 in Texas. I think my thought on it is,
it's good for electoral college stuff too. If you're looking at the election map,
right? Well, I think he's got a shot. I think he's got a shot that he didn't with Ted Cruz. The thing is with Ted Cruz, right? Ted Cruz, as a much of a horrible person, kind of Grandpa Munster thing that he is, right? He's like he turns out the insane radical base, right? For the right. He is that, and I don't see that happening so much. In the Senate race, who's the second senator from Texas at this point? Oh, I forget it. Let me see. Let me pull this up.
I'm here now.
Let's see. John Cornyn, right?
It's just an average white dude.
That's what I mean. It's like, so there's a different kind of opening, I think, in this race, right? You don't have him as kind of an iconic person. And I think O'Rourke is, you know, incredibly dynamic and kind of, you know, can turn people out, which, as you said, is going to have down ballot kind of effects. But actually, I think we'd have a shot on it. And I think that's going to actually have a national impact.
Yeah.
Because that's going to give so much kind of attention. So that's going to be interesting. I mean, both O'Rourke and Schumer are being kind of completely kind of tight-lipped about stuff at this point, whether or
so
not he's going
to
run. But
so, do you think the Democrats will keep the suburban voters in 2020?
Yes, I do.
Do you think they keep them forever, or do you think they go back after Trump's out of office?
I think they split after Trump's out of office. Right. I think that, it depends what happens with the Republican Party.
I mean, like, do they split and form their own party, or they split and go back to the Republican Party?
Because it depends what happens with the Republican Party.
Yeah.
If the Republican Party, like the next round of Republicans that are going to be running after Trump are going to be doubling down on white nationalism and things like this, then I think then those folks are gone. From the Republican Party, good chunk of them, right? I mean, not all of them, obviously, but
yeah,
I think so. But if you have a more moderate candidate, kind of come forward, or at least someone who kind of proclaims to be moderate and is not like just a horrible human being, then I think you're going to see those things.
I think those days are gone, though.
What's that?
I think those days are gone.
We'll see. Mitt Romney, he seems to be making moves once again. He doesn't look good, by the way. Have you seen Romney?
No, I haven't.
Romney looks like he's been like hanging out, like doing kind of some kind of weird fasting regime in his basement for too long. I mean, it's like, he does not look well. Does not look well.
You should get some, like, oh God, yeah,
sunlight. Yes, he should.
He needs some, like, alcohol and caffeine.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy. Well, so we'll see what happens with Beto. I'm really interested to see what happens with, I'm actually starting to get excited for the 2020 to kind of get rolling. They announced the first debate is going to happen in June. It's going to be MSNBC, NBC News, and what do you call it? I forget the name. It's the Spanish language channel.
El Día? No.
No, 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 no. That's, I can't believe. I was just talking about this like not too long ago. Telemundo, sorry. So they're going to be hosting a debate. That's going to be really cool. They also, Tom Perez has announced that the way that they're going to have, they're splitting candidates, they're going to have upwards of, they're cutting the debate off at 20 candidates because they expect the field to be longer. And remember, Republicans, when they had the large thing and everyone said it was this crazy field, that was 17. But they're saying they're going to have upwards of,
and 65,000 individual donors,
right,
which is pretty cool.
Right. Yeah. Well,
which shows you that they are giving credence to small dollar donations. And
but watch this, though, because here's the thing. So if you have, so they're going to split the interesting thing about the debates, the way the debates are going to be set up initially is that they're going to actually have like two heats instead of having like, you know, the adult table and the kids table like the Republicans did, where they're actually going to have two consecutive nights. And they're going to be randomly draw the candidates of who are going to appear on night one versus night two. So it's not going to be the showcase night, the stars, and then the rest of them. It's going to be kind of a mixed up from the beginning, which I think that's a really reasonable way of handling it. And it also could be also a way of kind of getting the Democratic Party message out there, especially progressive messages. I think it's going to benefit. So that's number one. The second part of it, though, is that they have those two like categories of how you make how you qualify, and one of them is a polling cutoff. Is it 5% again? Do you know offhand?
I'm not sure.
I can't remember what the polling is, but you have to poll at least like 5%, or maybe it's 3%. I'll have to look at that again. Maybe I'll pull that up a little bit later on. But so there's a polling cutoff, and that's pretty standard. And from what my understanding is, though, it's a lower one, right? It wants to be inclusive. And then a second one is a grassroots funding campaign, which is kind of what you were pointing to. Right, you have to show small dollar donations. Right, how much is 65,000? You said,
yeah.
Right, you have to show that in small dollar donations. Right, as a way of coming in. So it's a way of candidates who are kind of, you know, doing the grassroots organizing and out there to actually kind of qualify. What the interesting thing is, though, when Tom Perez was interviewed last night on Maddow's show about that, or maybe it was two nights ago, I can't remember, about this, was he initially said, well, it says the polling cutoff and the small dollar donations. But then when he was interviewed, he seemed to say that was the other option. If you don't clear the polling, then this is another way to make it to the debates. I wish they had it both, right? That you had to have the polling clearance and the small dollar donations, grassroots donations. But I think they're using it as an either or. So let's go crazy. Another kind of quick news before we go, very kind of congratulations to Denver teachers out there. First strike in what I guess it was about 25 years. They went out, they threatened last year after the wave of strikes. They went out this year, and in three short days of strike, like just like our ABSCA folks, they come away with a huge win. Great funding, more support for students in schools and everything like this. It shows once again that the teachers going on strike are really kind of leading the way. Pay attention, everybody in Pennsylvania. Strikes win. Amazon pulls out of New York after hundreds and hundreds of people basically continue to show up and shout them down about their plans.
Did you hear what the Amazon spokeswoman said about AOC?
No, what'd she say?
She was never Amazon.
She was never Amazon?
Yes. Quote, never Amazon, end quote. That is such a great, like...
Wow. I got to write that down. T-shirts will be available soon with that slogan, everybody, just so you know.
Hashtag never Amazon.
I'm writing that down. hashtag never Amazon.
Well, I don't think they're going to be moving to Pennsylvania, which is great.
Yeah.
Wolf said he's still in talks with them. Just maybe. just maybe, you know,
whatever.
It amazes me how like these fucking people want to call up as liberal or progressive, but and invite these companies into town when they're some of the worst companies out there. I mean, one of the reasons why Amazon left is because they didn't want to use labor union contractors.
Exactly.
And it's like, you're never going to go into Philadelphia or Pittsburgh with and bring in scab contractors to prop up your park. Like, you know what I mean?
Exactly. That's what the issue was. That was it.
Yeah. Like
it was that and well, the other part of it too as well is
like,
that,
do you think the building trades in Philadelphia would allow like Amazon to come in and build a park and use all non-union labor?
No.
I mean, come on. Like
right. I mean, you got, New York City is the highest density of labor, highest density of unionized labor in the country, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, number one. Number two is that you had a city council, right, that was actively exposing what the giveaways to Amazon had been, right? And the special treatment that Amazon was giving in terms of like being able to build on state land, right? I mean, a whole bunch of stuff that was going on, and they were confronted with it. Like, because Amazon used to be able to kind of cut its own deals and then go out and have a listening tour, which you tell people, you hear what people have to say. No, these New Yorkers were digging in, man. They were like, no, we're going to hold you accountable for these things. And finally they're like, you don't like us. You guys were never Amazon. And they went to play. They're going to go play. They're keeping their headquarters in Virginia. That, you know, because they split up in two. So we'll see if they have another one going. So we'll see. And by the way, go check out David Dayan's reporting on Amazon in these times. Had a great piece on them. What's happening actually in the secondary cities, like out in Tennessee and so on, and how that's you know, basically Amazon's model is basically, you know, seeing public funds and corporate giveaways like from public funds as part of the profit. I see
municipalities just cannibalize themselves over like who will like give the best deal. I mean, like, these people pay no fucking taxes to begin with.
Yep.
Yeah.
Crazy.
So much more I could say on this, but
yeah. So we're gonna.
Like, this whole entire system is just fucked up.
Yeah, it is.
Like
it
a
is.
Corporate welfare and just like this race to the bottom, and it like is amazing how it forces like people like Governor Wolf to get involved, who are like sympathetic to labor, but like, I mean, anyone knows that like Amazon is one of the worst companies out there to work for, some of the worst like labor practices out there. They'll fire anyone in wake of like their warehouses getting unionized, and it's like they're forced to participate in this race in the bottom because everyone else is.
Yep, that's right.
Or they have to cower to get these jobs.
Yep.
Because it's like, we need jobs. No, you don't need jobs. You like need to think about the whole entire, like, what displacing 50,000 people will look like for higher paying jobs.
Well, but
like
it's
displacing
also like,
whole entire neighborhoods and stuff like that.
No, exactly. But this is what the argument was in New York, right? So there was like this awesome. Let me see if I can pull it up. This is transportation census decision. Not going to be able to pull it up quickly. But so it's part of what the argument was coming out of New York was like, look, we're happy to have you come in and create whatever, several thousand jobs, right? But we're going to have a role in determining what kind of jobs they are, right? You do not get control over this. So that's part of the issue. If you come in, right, and you say, what kind of taxes are you going to pay? Right. And what kind of jobs you're going to create? You have to be able to create jobs for people in the community that are actually going to be kind of like sustaining jobs. Right. As opposed to just being like a way of kind of plop yourself down in the middle of the city, clear everyone else out who's poor so that you can make room for your kind of like, you know, flashy gentrification process.
Your own bubble.
Right. I mean, like, why wouldn't it be like your number one, like the number one call for like, you want Amazon, you come here? Sure, that's fine. That you're going to give whatever, like for the next 5 years, $1 million to the public school system for the next 5 years, every year. Right. I mean, it'd be like, I mean, little things like that. I mean, that could be. And this was kind of what their point was. Like, look, like, we're not saying that we're anti-Amazon. Right. And I know that's what they're saying, what some of them are saying. We're not anti-Amazon. We're anti this kind of approach to how things are going. So there you go. And as an aside, this is kind of a related thing, but it's not directly related. If you Chris Hayes has got this podcast called Why Is This Happening with Pod. And it's kind of a it's a really good podcast. It usually takes one person a week, and they do this extensive kind of deep interviews of someone. And I have to say, this one that just released, it's with Jesse Eisinger. It's called Can We Tax the Rich? Right. It's all about this kind of taxing the rich and how that is basically going to be part of the Democratic Party platform. Well, Jesse Eisinger has done some research on what's happened to the IRS over the past kind of like 20 years. And IRS is, again, nobody's loves the IRS. But I swear to God, you see what the right wing has done to the IRS and what that and how that connects to our ability to have something like a democracy. I swear to God, I came away from that very similar to how I think about what Amazon has been doing, like in all these municipalities. I feel like, man, you know, even when I think that I'm, you know, being part of a group that's making traction, I feel like I'm a freaking ant on a wall half the time of what these people have been able to do to kind of carve out a space for oligarchy within our country. So. Check that out anyways. That's my little plug for them. Just real quick, before we go to break, one, GOP has got a proposal out there. It's calling for employers to take student loan payments directly out of employees' paychecks. That is absolutely freaking insane. And so instead of, because we know that legislation was passed not too long ago that basically said that student loans are the only kind of debt that you're not allowed to kind of go bankrupt from. So you can't declare bankruptcy and get rid of your student loans. Nope, those will be with you to the grave, and then it will be kind of carried on to your dependents, right?
Instead of you know, solving the student loan debt crisis, you know, squeezing blood from a fucking stone is like the alternative.
That's right. That's right. And here's it. This is from CNBC. Just check this out. So this is from Lamar Alexander, Republican from Tennessee. Under his proposal, quote, there would be just two repayment routes, one in which borrowers' monthly bills are capped at 10% of their discretionary income, and another that spreads their payments out over a decade. So you get those are your two options. And then employers would be responsible for taking the funds from their employees' paychecks and sending them to the government. Right. Because we know the employers are the ones that we should trust with our money.
Yeah.
Right. So you basically you set up a kind of a system of wage theft. Right.
I mean, so what about those gulags again and a national emergency?
Exactly. Exactly. Where does Lamar Alexander go along with his billionaire buddies? Right. Well,
I mean, you think these people got to be afraid of like having their heads chopped off. With a guillotine like set up in front of the Capitol,
dude, man, bring back the pitchforks and torches, man. I mean, seriously, I mean, it's like, this is what these folks are saying. But again, I think like at this point, I don't think that's going anywhere, right? But it shows you where their mindset is, and this is like add more fuel to the fire at this point. You freaking assholes. I mean, just dump it on, because like, you know, and I think every single Democrat that's kind of running in 2020 should be pointing to this, say this is what the Republican Party wants to do. They want to dock your freaking paycheck till you're dead.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, come on. So there you go. The last thing I'll say before we go to break is that I've been fascinated by what's been happening in California in terms of the weather. They've been getting like record amounts of rain, and it's a fascination in that kind of way that, you know, I like to watch things blow up thing, you know, that kind of deal. Yeah. Right. I mean, it's scary. Right.
Here's the future.
What's that?
Here's the future.
Well, exactly. Right. I mean, it's, you know, it's my love of dystopian fiction, but I mean,
it's not all roses and honey.
No. And it's like, and it's frightening because of the fires that have been taking place, you know, that took place for like an unprecedented amount of fires this past year in California. You know, there's real fears of major mudslides, right? And mudslides are devastating. So not just floods, but we were talking like sides of mountains kind of sliding off, right, onto communities down below. I mean, it could be horrific. But and it's all part of this thing. It's called an atmospheric river. And I had never heard of this thing before. Now, Sean has recently told me that he has actually studied meteorology as part of his time at Kutztown, which now is going to be a problem because I'm going to probably have weather things to talk about every single freaking week. So
well, didn't we have like an atmospheric river set up over the summertime with all the rain we got?
Yes. But I hadn't realized how much you're talking, like how much, you know, I guess, or maybe I didn't pay attention to this. But they're basically saying that this system, this storm system, just listen to this. It's a massive gush. This is from Vox. Massive gushing river in the sky, a mile high, more than 300 miles wide, carrying up to 15 times the amount of water in the Mississippi River, right? And it just freaking dumping, right, on California. They've gotten more snow, right? And not just rain, but also snow. They've gotten more snow this past week than the Northeast has gotten all year, all season, right? I mean, it's been incredible. And this is exactly the kind of thing that you expect to deepen, right, with climate change, right, that you're putting more moisture up in the air. And so while this atmospheric river stuff, this is not brand new, right? This is a kind of a weather pattern that's been around for a while. The difference is that they're growing in size. So this is going to be pretty – it's going to be part of our future. So learn the terminology, folks, atmospheric river, right? That's what we can expect. So cool. All right. So we're going to take a quick break. And after this, we're going to come back with all sorts of fun that's happening out here in Pennsylvania. I want to remind you, if you can, become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/RC Press today. We will be right back after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1910. That was the day the uprising of the 20,000 officially ended in New York City. As many as 30,000 young, predominantly immigrant Jewish women went back to work after a bitter 11-week strike. They faced down their bosses, the police, and the courts. Arrests and fines drained much of the union's funds. Young union leaders like Clara Lemlich had been arrested 17 times and suffered 6 broken ribs. Women garment workers spent most of the winter running to union meetings, handing out leaflets, walking picket lines, raising funds, and distributing strike benefits. Many smaller shops settled in workers' favor early on in the strike. But by mid-February, closed shop demands kept many workers on the picket lines. The strike ended with partial but real victories. Garment workers won the 52-hour workweek, 4 paid holidays, employer-paid tools and materials, collectively bargained wages, and more. The International Lady Garment Workers Union started the strike with 100 members and had 20,000 by the end. All but 14 of the city's 353 shops signed contracts. But many garment workers continued to face unsafe working conditions like locked doors and flimsy or non-functioning fire escapes. Safety-related demands would not be addressed until after the 60,000-strong cloakmakers' strike the following summer. One of the largest factories and worst offenders was the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. Workers there went back with no agreement. 147 would die a year later in a tragic fire. In the aftermath, basic fire safety principles were finally established and implemented in New York State workplaces. These formed the foundations for many modern-day fire safety practices, like exit signs and doors, better ventilation, and sprinkler systems, fire alarms, and drills.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. And now we are the PA focus. And so, Sean, it looks like the big man is doing the, you know, the little kind of tour of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, through a hippie van.
The hippie van. Yeah. Is it like the Scooby-Doo mystery machine? Is that what you're driving around in? What's that?
The old VWs. Fetterman's having a marijuana tour throughout the state, and it's going well. The first two stops have like been to capacity, or if not more, at each of these places. So it's been interesting. From what I heard, like a lot of like conservative people show up and they're like, yeah, we smoke pot.
Yep.
Like, what are you gonna do? And also a lot of people who have trouble getting access to our medical marijuana system because of how expensive it is to get into it without even getting approved. People are like, well, someone had MS, and she's like, I've had MS for so many years. It's so hard for me to get into the medical marijuana system. It's so cumbersome, where she just buys, you know, her pot at time from her friend on the black market.
Yep.
And this is the stuff that people are dealing with, and should be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, and then, you know, I think it's, you know, again, let's be clear, is that Fetterman, his word, this is not a tour of college campuses. This is not a tour of urban centers, right? He is going around the state, right? And you're having, you start with Dauphin and Cumberland counties, right? You're not talking about kind of like, the progressive kind of liberal hippy-dippy areas of the state. So
it's going to be interesting to see how many people come out, like, once he's in the tier and come out for it, because I guarantee you it's probably going to be the same thing across the state. I mean, 70% of the state wants to legalize marijuana at this point. And, like, we're going to be legalizing it for all the wrong reasons, because, not that it just should be legalized, because in New York, and there's a race going on with New York and New Jersey.
Right.
And once they both do it, we're going to lose out on money for it, so...
Yep, money makes the world go round. That's what, and here we go. But that's gonna be kind of interesting to see how it plays out. And the thing is it does not break down politically. Does not necessarily break down in the ways that a lot of other issues break down too, as well, because you actually have Republican supporters that kind of are for legalization too, as well.
Yeah, and next week they're gonna be in Perry County and Duncannon, so that will be really interesting to see how that goes.
Nice. Yeah, and what's nice about Fetterman out there kind of leading the charge in this one, too, as well, is that he's out kind of in these areas, and I think that there's going to be the real kind of, like, assholes in the crowd are going to have a little second thoughts about trying to shout him down.
But he's also, like, not your typical politician. He has more in common with the people in the crowd.
Right.
And the people in the legislature.
Right.
So.
Right, exactly.
It's all about knowing your audience.
It is indeed. It is indeed. So what else we got going on?
House Democratic Labor and Industry Chair Pat Harkins got an earful last Friday. So as we were talking about this, Keystone Progress released a petition going after him, demanding he supports $15 an hour minimum wage. And then Penn Capital Star picked up on it, and the Capital, and then probably within 3 hours of that getting published, got an email from people said to stand down on Pat Harkins and not to escalate the situation any further, and that the governor's office was in contact with them and told them to get in line.
And he did.
And he did. Which, and I'm pretty sure, what the fuck?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's no appetite for that anymore.
Yeah. We shouldn't be, wasting our time on this.
Yep. So Pat Harkin is no longer calling for kind of less of a minimum wage increase, right? Or more modest one, a more conservative one. Nope. He's kind of like, he's found Jesus and found basically his way back home. And,
I don't know if he voluntarily found Jesus.
Well,
I think Jesus found him.
Yeah. Fair enough. More like Michael the Archangel, but if you want to go that way. Oh, man. So there you go. So we got a minimum wage plan back on track. It's still, once again, we'll see where that goes. Budget hearings are ramping up, right? So that the stuff is going to all start make its way through, and we're going to see what the actual proposals look like that are, before they get to governor's desk to sign. So you got any sense of that? What the appetite is in terms of support of Wolf's budget at this point?
I think there's a lot of appetite for getting his budget done, which
I'm right across the board.
A lot of his budget has the same proposals that Republicans put in there a couple years ago with moving money transfer funds around. So one of the things that's happening, not really talked about, last year, the Supreme Court reinstated the cash assistance fund, which was gutted and taken out of the budget by Corbett.
Right.
So there's $400 million they have to have in the budget. And so instead of having the cash assistance fund, Wolf is using money transfers from the cash assistance fund and funding other programs with it. And he's doing this with a lot of things in the budget.
Yeah, he's using those same gimmicks. And they're like, the Republicans are like, yeah, good, he got on board. This is what...
He's using the smoke and mirrors budgets that he called smoke and mirrors budgets back in 2015 and 16 with the Republicans, and he's getting on board. Sort of doing the things we expect anyone to do right after you win an election by 20 points.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So instead of kind of having a bold agenda to move forward to actually kind of use a mandate, you're going to actually kind of be as cautious and deer mousy as possible.
And there's a lot of people who are not happy with the budget, staffers and people in the different caucuses and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was kind of like totally underwhelmed by it. As I've dug in more, in particular, it's interesting about how some of the Democrats.
Why are we rating environmental and welfare funds to like one-time money transfers for like other programs?
Yeah, it's
instead
a great
of like
question.
Actually, Steve wrote about it in the Capital Star with DEP, and that was getting asked about this week at the hearings. But why are we putting out like this wishy-washy budget?
Got me.
And the Republicans, there's no appetite for a minimum wage this year, it looks like.
Yep. Yep.
This session.
Yep. I mean, I think a lot of you see some of the attempts to spin this budget as a really good budget and kind of moving forward and things like kind of initially I saw some of that. It's really hard to maintain that as a talking point that this is somehow.
This is like we don't want to work hard.
Yeah. Well, and here's what I wonder is going to happen, because you remember.
I think not banking on the Republicans fucking up the budget process months from now.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like their conventional wisdom is, but I've talked to some people, within the caucuses who believe that the Republicans are just going to go ahead and have like a 4 or 5 month budget shutdown. So it's kind of hard to like get that see where they're going.
Yeah, and what's going to be interesting is that if you remember that one of the reasons why Pennsylvania had its credit rating downgraded was in part because of exactly these kind of like, smoke and mirrors budgeting stuff that they've done in the past. And they were cited explicitly in like in the credit ratings reports. I don't know if it was Standard & Poor's or whatever it was, the S&P rating kind of downgraded the credit because of this and warned. It said like unless Pennsylvania actually stops doing this and actually has real budgets that it's actually, and funds its expenses, then it's going to lose its credit rating more. So we're going to see what happens there, because if that's what goes on with the smoke and mirrors stuff, you can guarantee that is going to be kind of front and center in some of the Republican talking points about what Governor Wolf has done. So pay attention for that, folks.
Yeah.
Crazy. So and then, it seems that there's some issues with the Pennsylvania Post-Gazette.
Yeah, some minor ones.
Some minor ones. So walk us through this. This was quite a story.
I haven't really dug too much into it. But so last week, last Saturday night, John Block went on a drunken rant with his daughter present, like 11 or 12-year-old daughter. We're talking about something really young, minor. And
well, say, where is he? Like, paint us the picture.
He's inside the newsroom Saturday at like 10 o'clock at night. And this is like mainly like when your like actual workers are in there, the night's editor and night cop and stuff like that, are in there like doing this. This is like the 11 to 7 shift. And there's a big sign poster on the bulletin board that said "Shame on the Blocks." And he went in there drunk and was demanding to have his picture taken by one of the photographers present. And to have that picture of him standing in front of the "Shame on the Block" sign ran on the front page of the news. And this is as he's in there drunk and as is forcing his daughter in this picture. And she's like crying. There's pictures of this that are surviving. And as this tirade is going on, people are recording this with their cell phones. So after happened, word gets out to the other locals, the other alternatives in Pittsburgh, gets reported on, and it gets Block's, John Block's brother. So like John Block's like the senior editor there, right?
Mm-hmm.
His brother is the one who owns the managing company, the managing publishing firm. He releases a statement, people's statements are being misconstrued and blah, blah, blah. They really don't know what they're talking about. They're just overstating things because the contract fight that's going on, he's really not that dangerous. So this story comes out, and yesterday the Pittsburgh Writers Guild was like, we thought long and hard about this because there's a minor involved, and we didn't want it to come to this, but we have to respond because of like the statement that like Block's brother put out saying nothing really bad happened. So they released four written eyewitness accounts of what happened, put it in a press release and sent out to everyone. And like literally like one of the women working there that night had to take his daughter down to a cafeteria to like calm her down and to like, what do I do with this kid?
Yeah.
Like her dad just went on like this, like he went on such an epic rant. Or like this is where people lose their children over because of like this type of stuff.
Yeah, there's a one of the web editor, Marianne Mazera, she kind of like wrote about kind of what happened there, and this is from Splinter magazine. She kind of republished some of her comments. So just gotta, here's how this was written up by Post Gazette's web editor. She says, in his heightened, agitated state, Mr. Block continued to walk back and forth in front of the Guild bulletin board and continued with his belligerent behavior. He did not want to he did not and would not calm down. He repeatedly shouted out rude comments about various current and former managers, mocking them, saying some had gone to the dark side. The newsroom staff, which he called the working class, and his ex-wife. This is all in front of his 12-year-old. Right. And he bemoaned what he called a loss of millions of dollars on part of the company. And then he yelled at his daughter up in her face saying, you're a Block. Don't you forget it. You're a Block. You're not one of them. Repeatedly as he firmly jabbed his finger into her shoulder. Right.
So. Yeah, this guy went on like a rant for the ages. Can you imagine just like being in a newsroom and this happening? I mean, like the newspaper guild. Like the person from the newspaper guild was called. It's like, you need to get down here. Like, we don't know if he's going to shoot people at this point. Like, I mean, that's where like they were. He went on a totally unhinged rant. Like, do you know what it's like spending hundreds of millions of dollars into a newspaper? Do you know what it's like being me? Like, imagine telling that to like one of your fucking workers.
Oh my God, it's just crazy. Well, and I guess
I mean, I wonder if it opened up like if. Would like if the opportunity presented itself, and you had like him on a drunken rant, and he gets up in your face, do you take that shot?
It's hard not to. I mean, you know what I'm saying. I mean, it's like I mean, I'm not saying I'm not happy about that, but
I mean, do you take the shot if he like presents itself and just like, all right, we can end this now. Yep. I'm not. You're not one of us. Boom.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, apparently like, he was calling for like, yeah, exactly. Imagine this, right? So this is how it closes out. So he kept on calling for the managing editor, right? Whose name is Sally Stapleton, right? And so finally she kind of comes on to try to kind of like handle the situation, right? And it was like so. Meanwhile, so he was slapping and kicking the wall near the Shame of the Block sign and pounding his fist. And finally, Sally, the managing editor, comes down, showed up what after is like 20 or 30 minutes. And this is, again, from published in Splinter. And he continued ranting and raving to her. And this one, check this out. He told her that she was going to be in the office to 1 to 2 a.m. every Saturday. And he told her the newspaper was going to hell and that he was going to burn the place down. I mean, this so guy should, actually, you know what? I said, all I have to say is,
you're going to the jail.
That's what should happen.
So, like, in his office, right? Because, like, we actually hear stories from, like, a couple of the people who, like, write for the Post-Gazette.
Yeah.
He spent, like, an insane amount of money put this to, like, have this, like, $100,000 piece of printing equipment. Like a printing press, like an old-fashioned printing press, mount it in his office. In the Post-Gazette newsroom.
Just so he could look at it?
Yeah. Like, yeah, like...
Wow.
Imagine working for them and like, yeah, I don't want to deal with this.
Yeah, that'd be hard not to...
I mean, it's like the Pittsburgh Tribune is becoming the liberal paper now.
Well, it's crazy because, I mean, there's...
Escapes of all people started.
I know, exactly. And I loved the Pittsburgh, the reporters, the journalists at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. I mean, again, like every paper's got its, you know, stuff like that. But I've thought they've done such excellent reporting over the years, especially on education stuff, on some labor stuff. And to see this happening to the paper, too, is, I mean, whatever. I mean, I guess it's been going on for a long time, but still, I feel for those folks out there. So,
yeah.
Cool. Yes, indeed. So kind of do a quick, this way I've been, this is the time of year, which I spend a little time watching budget hearings, which is, you know, always riveting. And, this, yeah, we have once again, the big little news here. I saw this initially from Jan Murphy from out there in Harrisburg, is that she tweeted this out, that basically that Chancellor Greenstein basically said that, you know, they're going to have to start working collaboratively with the union. That the relationship has got to change. And if it doesn't, then, you know, trying to save the Pashi system is basically going to be a fool's errand. And the suggestion was that the union is the problem and the collective bargaining contract is the problem. Right. Or let me say that to be perfectly accurate, is a major impediment to the kind of change that he says is necessary in order to save the state system of higher education. And that should like be read in my mind as a shot across the bow for the faculty union. So there's really, it's becomes really important to kind of put these moves in context. He says, right, Greenstein basically comes out and says, look, we're not talking about changes around the edges. He said, you can listen to the two as well. I've been toying around with the fact of pulling out some of this and doing some commentary and a separate release for the podcast, and I still might do that. But he basically says, you know, look, he says, we're not doing stuff around the edges anymore. We're not kind of like doing reform. We're doing fundamental transformation. He says, at the end of this year, at the end of this year, we're going to have our plan set, and next year is going to be a very difficult year, right? And it's going to be hard and be hard choices. And what he's basically pushing the legislators to do is to make sure that they give the board, right, the Board of Governors, the State System of Higher Education, they give the board the authority to make those hard choices, right? And on the table were things like the collective bargaining contract, right? Act, what was it, 88? I guess so, 188 or 88, was the one that basically formed the state system of higher education, said the changes need to be made in there. And some kind of radical kind of restructuring of the university systems. He did say, or universities of the state system, he did say that he was not for closure of any of those universities, but to actually, in a sense, repurposing kind of how they approach their missions. So all that stuff, and if you watch him deliver it, right? I mean, he is, I call him Chancellor McDreamy, right? Because he's, you know, he's very well put together. The guy's got nice hair, you know, he's very smart. He clearly, he kind of knows what he's talking about in terms of what the agenda is. And he, you know, he comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I mean, he was basically doing education reform for K through 12 with them. And so he's been in that Silicon Valley world. And part of, so, you know, he's compelling as a figure. And I think in particular for progressives who have always been wooed by the high tech folks, he's a challenge. He's a challenge like we haven't seen before, in part because he's talking about fundamental transformation. And I do believe that that's essentially what he wants. And he's got the chops in order to kind of do this. What that actually means, for the rest of us who actually work in the system and kind of go through this is going to be, you know, the jury's still out on that. But all the more reason why I'm very happy that tomorrow that at Kutztown University, I'm going to be joining kind of a few dozen of my brothers and sisters from ABSCUF, from Kutztown University and a couple other universities in the state system for a labor notes training. And we're going to do an all-day training. And part that is about, you know, kind of grassroots building power is like how you actually kind of build power in a union from the grassroots up, how you build rank and file power that doesn't rest in the, you know, hoping that the leadership of your local union or the statewide union does the right thing. Right. Not banking on kind of relationships that your union president has with insiders in Harrisburg and politicians and corporate executives and all that kind of stuff. I mean, anybody who's been in a union or any organization knows this dynamic. But instead of that, saying basically it's going to take rank and file organizing and building power from the ground up. It's, as Sean has always says, direct action is what gets the goods. And it means kind of building an organization that's capable of acting in that way. So that's, you know, kind of part of what we're we're doing on a kind of more localized basis to try to prepare for what we see as what we're concerned, at least, could be some really some very negative consequences for a whole lot of people. So we'll see. Anything else going on in Pennsylvania, Sean?
I did not, but something we forgot to talk about.
What?
In the first.
What did we forget?
Lyndon LaRouche died.
Oh, my God. I know. I burned a candle for him. Did you?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. It was made up. I had a special candle that was rolled up pamphlets that he hands out to me at every protest that I got. I dipped it in wax and set it on fire. Yeah, Lyndon LaRouche is dead, everybody.
Now all we need is a vacant to go next.
Yeah, who's going to be setting up those card tables, talking about the kind of the British are coming? You know, who else is going to be, you know, kind of waving the flag for, you know, the warnings about the reemergent British Empire that's trying to undergird our thing? I mean, who else? Who else, Sean?
Trump.
Trump. Oh, well, there you go. Never mind. Oh, cool. There we have it. All right. Remind everybody, become a member of Raging Chicken Press, patreon.com/RC Press, as little as $5 a month. We'll be right back with today's Last Call. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull no punches, progressive reporting and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/RC Press and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/RC Press. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. It's today's last call. And yeah, we don't have a whole lot for today's last call. It's kind of a little more freewheeling. Sean's not feeling well. My kids are home from school. It's an in-service day for them. So I hear my dog scratching at the door upstairs because he was downstairs ripping stuff apart this morning. So, you know, here you go. This is kind of where we're at. The one beer news I got for the week is... Free Will today. They've been doing a lot of Saturday releases, but today they actually got one on Friday release, which I'm pleased about. They're releasing their Mango Wheat and Chasing the Dragon. Now, Chasing the Dragon is one of my favorite beers that they put out. It is an Imperial Imperial IPA. I'm sorry. And it's super good. And what's cool about Chasing the Dragon is that the concept was, and I'm just going to go ahead and assume that they're still doing this. The concept has always been like, this is at about kind of that like optimal, super hoppy, looking for kind of packing in and can see what you can do with it, right? And so I've always loved Chasing the Dragon, which is really good. Mango Wheat, I'll be honest with you, it's not one of my favorites, but some other people swear by it. They love it. I actually love like mango wheat beers a lot, but last time I had it wasn't kind of just wasn't one of my favorites. Not that it was bad, I wasn't good, but I'm actually going to pick some up now because I was talking to somebody a couple weeks back and they said that they've kind of redone some of the mango wheat stuff, so I'm going to give it another shot. So I'm hoping so because I actually really like that that flavor. So we have there. So that's what I got for beer news from Free Will this week. I will give you one little update from Star Trek. Star Trek Discovery, if you remember last week, I didn't get a chance to watch it before our podcast. I have watched it now since, and it still rocks. And what I'm really interested to see, for those any kind of Trekkies out there, is that where this storyline is going. I'm really hesitant. I want to actually tell you everything about what's going on, but then I'm going to spoil it for people watching it. But it's really cool. It's just a really cool storyline. And what I like right now is that they've introduced, there's this it's like a special forces unit right in there. You may have seen some of this stuff, but it's like kind of like their black ops team. And what I really like about some of the things that is happening with Star Trek is that they're pursuing some storylines that I've always felt have not been really fully explored. And that is, like, okay, Star Trek, like, the vision of Star Trek is kind of like the socialist utopia, high-tech socialist utopia future, right? The idea is that you've gotten rid of money, right? People are no longer doing things for profit. They're doing for exploration and all this other kind of stuff. Picard actually played some of this on a podcast last year where Captain Picard in The Next Generation talks explicitly, is actually one of the Star Trek movies, talks explicitly about kind of like moving beyond capitalism, right? And that's always been one of my appeals, right, since I was young, kind of about seeing that as a positive future. But there's some kind of always some dark sides to this, right? You can't tell me that it's a perfect utopia. And what's happening in this season, just like when in the first season launched, it was very much about kind of racial purity of the Klingons, and that was paralleling what was happening in our own country in terms of the rise of white nationalists, and they're doing that kind of dialogue. And here you're looking at the underside of this season, start looking at the underside of what it takes to establish this future, because Discovery happens before anyways, but so you start to see the rise of these kind of like black ops teams and things like this in Star Trek that are really morally ambiguous for there. So it's kind of a really cool dynamic, not to mention that you've got like spore drives, which are kind of like, you know, mushroom spore driven space folding stuff, which is cool. So anyways, that's my little Star Trek geek out for the moment. But do check it out if you can. It's on CBS All Access, which kind of sucks. You got to pay for it. It's not just on broadcast TV, but it's really, really good. So, yeah. And so, Sean, you've been watching your own series of sorts.
Yeah, I've been watching Oliver Stone's Untold Histories of the United States. Sort of a play on the Howard Zinn book.
Uh-huh.
But it starts off from like middle of World War II up through modern day, and pretty much like looks at like our nuclear policy and stuff like that. And, you know, pretty much talks about Truman being wholly unqualified to become president, but was whisked in there when there was an opposition against Henry Wallace in the election. He should have been vice president, and how that pretty much like changed the course of history for the United States. But one of the underlying like theses of his stuff. Because of Wallace was an extreme pacifist and actually wanted to work with the Soviets instead of, like, you know, having a nuclear arms race with them, and pretty much detailing how, like, pretty much the Soviets have had that ambition because they could have never matched or beat the United States militarily.
Mm-hmm.
like our estimations, like, what we're severely under, like, handed with how much like nuclear weapons they actually had in the 60s and 70s before it got out of control. But
that's always interesting too as well, because remember, because during the Reagan administration, it's like one of the things that was explicit about what a Reagan administration wanted to do is they recognized they had the intelligence that basically said, look, the Soviet Union, it's a power, but it's hiding kind of an economy that can't compete. And so one of the reasons of ramping up both the space race, right, the Star Wars stuff, which you kind of mentioned when we were talking before the show, but also ramping up the number of nuclear warheads and everything like this, was a move to try to bankrupt the economy, right? Was a move to try to say, you're going to push them beyond capacity and force them to do things in the economy that's going to make people suffer. And that was part of the conscious choices they made.
And I mean, like, the Russians did make a lot of opportunities to like, make peace and end it because of their economy, because at the time, like 25% of their GDP was being eaten up by this military industrial complex that they built up themselves, and it could have been used elsewhere.
Right. Right. Exactly.
And yeah, and then it talks about like all of our shit that like Elliot Abrams and others did in down in Guatemala and Central America and stuff like that.
The secret wars, man. The secret wars.
Yeah.
Crazy. Crazy cools. We'll check that out. Cool news here. Raging Chicken Studios, as Sean can see. No one else will see. See this, Sean? See that? Look, I'll give you a little go around, right? Give Sean that kind of like video tour. We got a little remake. I posted some pictures on Instagram kind of about it, which is kind of cool. And by remodel of the thing, basically I'm moving furniture around in my basement, to be honest with you. So it was like no purchase of anything for it. It's just kind of like moving things around. So I had a little bit more room because I was like in this little tiny hole before. But what's kind of cool about this down the road, we'll see where this goes. I've got a lot of ideas, as I've mentioned before, and you're probably sick of hearing me complain about it. But, you know, I've been just like out of it for months. And some of that starting to kind of like abate and something like that, sort of think again and stuff. And so we're trying to figure out, okay, how do we move forward? Because as I'm sure that people have noticed is that there's not a whole lot that's been going up on Raging Chicken Press lately. We've had an article here, an article there, but it's been pretty empty for a while. We had Lou Ryan's latest piece is kind of up there. She does amazing work. And that part of it, that's on my shoulders because I just have not been able to really do the kind of concentration. So I'm trying to kind of rethink about where we go and how we move forward. One of the things that's cool about this new redesign of the studio is that it opens up the possibility of actually having people here in the studio and actually do live interviews and stuff, which is kind of cool. And one of the things, I don't know if you remember this, was one time that Sean was home for, I think it was Christmas break or something, Sean, or
summer, summertime.
Yeah, and you kind of came over and we tried to do kind of like a live stream and thing from kind of my house. And it was kind of like, it was just awkward to do because I didn't really have a place to do it. So we jerry-rigged something. But now we actually have a space. We can actually have a round table. We could sit down with mics and stuff and have a discussion, which is really cool. As you may know, I've interviewed her before, and she's been here before. Colleen Clements. She's was one of the co-founders of Inside 254 podcast, which they just kind of closed out their podcast earlier this year. She lives kind of not far from me too as well, so maybe we can have her in the studio to have some discussions at some point. Bring some other people from the area, maybe hopefully to talk about local economy stuff and things like that. We'll see where we're going to play with this. But it's really good to have a space and actually be able to think about, okay, what we can actually do in this space. So that's number one. Number two, the other thing is that, you know, I've had, and if people listen to this podcast, if you are one of them, is that, so I've got about three or four different people who have kind of approached me either through recommendations or approached me directly about being interested in writing for Raging Chicken Press or participating in some ways at Raging Chicken Press. And I've been a little bit behind. I've kind of said, okay, let's see what's going to go on. Well, I think we're at the kind of point to start kind of moving forward on that. So, my goal moving forward, I'll be perfectly frank with everybody, and so, you know, and keep their ears out, is that I think that, you know, really, number one, one of the missions of Raging Chicken from the get-go has been to kind of develop new writers, right? It was basically have a low barrier of entry for people that want to do activist media, and helping kind of train that kind of next generation and bringing them through. I mean, Sean's a perfect example of this. I mean, Sean's been self-motivated from the get-go, but wanting to kind of do this. But I mean, you know, you had no experience doing this before, right, Sean?
Nope.
Yeah, I mean, just kind of came in and, like, you know, it was kind of like me. But we started and it was all new. Right? It was all new. And then, you know, Sean's gone from the guy who was sitting like on the, you know, the seat outside my office door. Say, you remember me from Stephen Schnell's class? Right? You know, and want to be interested in getting doing involved and kind of trying to kind of work out this stuff with me. And gone to now kind of, you know, breaking news stories and doing all this kind of amazing work out there in Harrisburg. And that's the kind of, I think, trajectory we want to move forward for a bunch of reasons. The past couple of years is that I've not put the same kind of energy, I think, right, in making kind of identifying kind of new people to move forward. We had a couple fits and starts. We had some interns that didn't work out very well. We had kind of try to bring on some writers that were do some things for a short period of time, but then really wasn't able to do that, or life kind of stuff like interfered. But you know, been reaching out, but not as kind of directly as now. So hopefully, if things play out the way that I hope they're going to play out, we may actually be able to get some folks from say the Lehigh Valley area, which was one of my hobby horses forever. Another writer from Philadelphia has been involved with a bunch of activist work down in there, and a couple folks that have been involved with DSA, particularly some people from the Pittsburgh DSA. I think that moving forward to 2020, one of the things that's going to be absolutely critical is that that we're going to be reporting on what's actually going on in these places around the state. To see what's happening, especially with activists and DSA, and other organizations, particularly around kind of immigration and stuff. And in order to do that, we really need writers on the ground. I've been contacted by people periodically who say, "Hey, can you come to this?" Or, "You know, we like you to have you do this." And frankly, we don't have the personnel for it. Right? I would love if like I was could able to just kind of like, you know, pick up and go, but I don't. You know, I mean, Sean and I both have put this together as kind of, you know, a labor of love of sorts, because we have to make our money elsewhere. Right. We have other obligations and we do this when we can. And so kind of moving that, kind of trying to build that out is going to mean identifying new writers and kind of changing up the format a little bit. We've been getting a lot of really positive feedback on the podcast, which is great for me to hear, because for a while you don't know who's listening and what people are saying about it. But we've been getting some really good feedback on the podcast. And so one of my thoughts also too as well is to kind of really kind of invest a little bit more in there to kind of bring some – get back to doing some of the interviews that I was doing there for a while in addition to our Out the Coop podcast, just so that we're going to kind of, you know, build that out a little bit. So look forward to some of that stuff. And I like, you know, if you got ideas, things that you'd like to see and stuff, go ragingchickenpress@gmail.com. Just send me an email and kind of let me know what's on your mind, and we'll see where we go from there. But that's what I got. Anything else for the good of the order, Sean?
No, it's good.
Sean is nursing his sinus infection or whatever it might be, and is head cold. You can hear him coughing in the background. So I know. Thanks for being a sport, Sean. I know. I know that you were not feeling good this morning. So we did, and we didn't do too bad, right? From a kind of a later start, do too bad. All right. Well, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Thanks for sticking with us, and wishing you all a great weekend. Enjoy the national emergency.
Yep. I'll talk to you later.
See ya.
You could have had money for the wall, but the wall is not the issue. And the border, this very real stretch of land with people and families and businesses and churches on both sides of the line, is not the issue. The issue is what this country as a whole looks like and who gets to call it theirs. Which is why the wall will never be built and always be needed. Why the border will never actually be secure but always need to be secured. It's because America cannot be and will not be, one hopes, the kind of nation that those folks want. The president, his advisors. One bound fundamentally by ethnic and racial affiliation rather than a collective vision of a free society.